This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Hi listeners, this is Brent Sutton. Welcome to the 79th episode of the Practice of Learning Teams podcast show. On today's podcast, I conclude my two-part series with Dave East from Crew Fusion. Dave continues to share his story of using learning teams in the armed service in Australia, and more importantly, the shift from accident investigations to event learning. So please sit back and enjoy the conclusion of this podcast with Dave East.
Because if people don't connect, they won't buy in. If there's no connection, why would they buy in?
Of course. Yeah. Well, we're in a very lucky position. Of course, the military has a fantastic support system within it, right? So for us, our why, we get simple things like the RAF News. It's a newspaper that comes out fortnightly. And you can look in that any time, look at the front page and look at us delivering humanitarian aid to a country that's just been affected by a cyclone or a volcano, and you go, there's our why. That's one piece of what we do, and that makes it a bit easier. But yeah, when you run that little exercise with a small group, with a small team, some of the whys are, I've always wanted to join the military. I've always wanted to work around planes. I've always wanted to help people. So the why becomes sort of easy. But if you want to dig into it deeper, it can get complicated because they just hang their hat on an easy one, I want to march in Anzac Day. Sometimes it's not enough. You need more. So, yeah, with these guys, I found, no matter where you work, you find a mix of people, don't you?
The bell curve. It's just the normal bell curve.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
You find it with safety people.
Yep. There's nothing you can't solve with a standard bell curve.
Absolutely.
I tell you what, so when we bought, the Air Force already had a system in place that understood conditions, okay? But they weren't using it. Well, CSG wasn't really aware of it because it was an aviation thing. It was a DFSB thing, unfortunately. So we've got, in the Air Force, we've got a system, what do you call them, the pre-works? We call it PBED, pair, rule of three. So PBED, plan, brief, execute, debrief. Okay. Pair is a little notepad that they're everywhere within the Air Force, within the military. People, environment, actions, resources, and they're your conditions. Okay. It's a little notepad with all these conditions embossed in the background to help you through a list of what can catch you out today.
Yeah, okay. So I call that a little thinking frame.
Of course, that's a good name for it. Yes. Yeah. And then the rule of three is, of course, a little ID card size, credit card size piece of plastic that we're given, which is the standard traffic light system. If you're in the green, you can go to work. If you've got more than three conditions out of that pair pad, then you need to stop and talk to management so we can reduce them and look at the conditions and get to a point where we can work safely. Okay. And that blew their mind when I explained this system to them. Like, I've been using it for many years as aircrew. It blew their mind. They're like, where have you been all my life? This is amazing stuff. So then we had a point where, whenever someone went out and did a critical job or a job that they determined needed the pre-works, the PBED pair, rule of three, I'd get together with them and I'd run through them. I taught them how to do it efficiently, which was great. But then we got to a point where we had do we make this mandatory before every single job? Is it directed that we have to do this? Or at what jobs do we do this, and what jobs, what level of criticality in the job do you need to do these? Because once you make them mandatory, and I had seen some fighter squadrons up in Amberley made them mandatory, and then your pre-works turned into a 30-minute to 40-minute to sometimes an hour activity where you just had a team standing around killing time because they weren't effective anymore. So that's where you've got to be really careful to make sure that you manage it correctly.
I think it's a challenge because I think there's two components to that I see in particular. One is, who gives permission? Is the system giving permission to the worker that it's okay for them to start? Or is it the worker giving the system permission? And I'm always fascinated by this because so much of what we build, we use this language about, is it safe to start or safe to stop? But what's the system got to do with that?
Because it's the worker that's going to put his hand up.
Absolutely.
His hand up, yeah.
And so much of, and now I think about the things that you've talked about, they're classic examples where we're asking people to assess or evaluate. And in our latest little white paper, Learning from Everyday Work, we actually talked about the fact that very little of these things actually ask people to critically appraise. And what's more important, like if you're facing, because no matter what the colour there is, no matter what colour is, there's going to be some residual risk left over.
Yes.
So isn't appraisal more important than evaluation? Because the thing that I always struggle with is we talk about you can't see human error coming, which I absolutely agree with, because you only know once it's become an error that it was an error. But how do we support workers in particular to see when things start to shift away from their normal state? And what type of skill do we need to be able to see that? And the language that we use, we call it critical thinking skills.
Mm-hmm.
To know when something starts to shift away from, you know, what its expected state or what you think it should be. And then have that capacity to stand back and ask why. Versus what we talked about before about people, a lot of our systems are asking people what and how and when and who. Yeah.
It's it's another one of those interesting questions, as it that interesting point. At what point do you do that? It is very interesting. I used to say that a lot. You can do this PBAD pair rule of three at any time during your activity. You're all very smart people. You've been trained. You know your job. You are competent at it, and you will gain more experience, and you will get better at it. Everyone has a voice. You all have the ability to put your hand up and say, "Hey, look, this is something we need to look at."
Yeah, and if you see the value in it, you'll actually use it.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you don't see the value in it,
yep.
You're unlikely to engage unless there is a team culture or a tribal culture that you do, if that makes sense. You get those two components come together. In your case, in the military, it's quite hierarchical because if you don't, then that's actually something that could, you know, be counted against you within your career.
No, to a point. Yeah, we are very much an organisation where, yes, I talked about rank before, but we are all empowered to put up our hands if we see a problem, 100%.
Right. So what's the difference between a mandate and an order in the military?
To be honest, I can't remember the last time I was given an order in the Air Force, which is good. We've got certain rules to follow, and everyone knows that we know to do our job, and we are expected to do it to the best of our ability. And if we can't, then we put our hand up and you know, ask for help. And that's a great organization for that. Yeah. I can't say all military services are the same.
I think if we think about Australia and New Zealand, if we think about our brotherhood that we have, our military services really provide a lot of support around the Pacific and around supporting fisheries and supporting. It's not about a pure defensive capacity. There's a lot of it is around support capacity.
Look, most of the work I've done, like real work, like when I say real work, I mean actually out there helping people, has been humanitarian aid.
Yeah. I was going to say like here
to the South Pacific, to the Philippines, to the Oz-Indo region. It's great.
If we had a real war over here, we'd have to try and arm our sheep, and we probably don't have bullets to go around. So,
can we please not get into a discussion about New Zealand military decisions over the years?
I know. It just continues to be underinvested.
Oh, look, I've worked with the Kiwis plenty, and I love working with you guys, except for the fact, the only thing I don't like about working with New Zealanders is the fact that your bags are 10 times heavier than our equivalent bag size. I don't know what your army guys jam into their bags, but they are so heavy. But as far as professionalism goes, you guys...
I think they have to pack a lot more because they don't know what's going to happen next.
Is that right? No, that's good.
Yeah, because we've got poor logistics. So you try and take more on board.
I can tell so many stories around that, but probably not the best.
No, that's right. That's right. But look, our services do an amazing job. It is a credit to them. And I'd like to thank them for their service.
Yeah, so do I. Yeah. They're just incredible. Yeah.
So for you, this awakening and then seeing it live and seeing it in action and seeing how, do you think that it's actually helped people in their own personal life as well? Some of these things that you've done?
100%. Yes. I could see that immediately. As well, like I mentioned before, I also like the human factors program itself is quite good. It's got a lot of valuable information. I was concerned as to whether it was the right training to provide them, but yeah, that's what we sort of not what we had to work with, like that we were told to provide that. There was definitely flexibility in it. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to do a lot of research into the best product to provide this team so that they could improve. The effectiveness of it, to answer your question, it's when we delivered... when we added psychological safety and emotional intelligence and active listening, those sort of concepts into the course, they weren't part of the human factors portion, but they were essential. You couldn't do A without B. That changed a lot of lives. We had to train the entire support force. Some of these people are literally working in the HRA, is a high reliability organizations daily. And some of them were chefs. And I'm not saying a kitchen isn't dangerous, because a kitchen in a mess is dangerous. It can be a dangerous place. Some of them are physical training instructors. And I struggled with, okay, how do I train these people? Like what can I provide them? Because they're all in the same classroom together. And when it came to these human performance topics like the EQ and psychological safety, it blew their minds. They were like, yes, this is something that I wish I learned when I was in my 20s, is a fairly common sort of feedback that we'd get, because it is vitally important. And as a shameless plug, that's also why I've developed my own business, Crew Fusion, because I've realized the benefit that all of these topics have for any organization. It doesn't matter who you are, where you work, so long as you've got a brain and you're a human, this stuff is amazing and it works for everyone. And that's why it's great that this community is doing what it is doing, because it changes lives.
And I think the language I use, Dave, is that I say to people, you know, curiosity is king. And curiosity is something that we have an abundance of as a child. And it either got beaten out of us, and I don't mean beaten as in literal, but it got beaten out of us because of rules and schools and everything else. But that curiosity is something that has just remained dormant. It's there. It's always there. And I think what you're saying is that by doing this, we've simply brought that curiosity back into the front of the mind again.
Yeah.
Back to life. And isn't that just amazing? Just what, how curiosity can do so much.
I know. It's amazing. And there's just an endless amount of information. If you find your subjects and your topics and your genre that you like, there is so much information out there for it.
Yeah. And the person you became was because of that curiosity. So I think for me, curiosity is something that our brain sees as being a very positive state, because that was part of our key, you know, some of that learning type thing, that experimenting, even though sometimes it ended up in trauma when we're told not to touch something and we did.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
But that curiosity is not something we got from it was not nurture, it was from nature.
Good point. Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't we look at these things that we get from nature and then leverage them into, and I think that's what you're trying, that's what you've been doing, is actually just bringing those things to life.
Yes.
Rather than trying to rewire someone to think differently. Yeah. You're just using the best of what they've got. And we talk about, we try and get people to look at things through a different lens rather than their own lens. Because they can look at through a different set of eyes. That's what allows them to reflect.
And isn't that the beauty of getting a group together? So obviously you get different personalities, different job roles, and you start talking about each other. And yes,
correct, because it's not right nor wrong. And I've just been writing an article for Jeffrey Lith at the Safer Differently Forum, and it's called "People Aligned to Stories, Not to Numbers."
Storytelling. Yeah. I don't care about maths.
Absolutely.
Storytelling is where it's at.
Absolutely.
That's for
sure.
Stories
that, because even if the story is totally against our belief, there'll be something in that story that will stick with us over time.
Yes. Yep. It's all about, you can go into the neural pathways, but if you're fascinating these neural pathways in some way, shape or form, you will remember a portion of that story or all of it, 100%.
Absolutely. And once again, that's why I keep going back to it. It's curiosity that helps us to do that. And the problem is our systems, our formal systems, aren't good at curiosity.
Very linear, aren't they?
Yeah, they try to use continuous improvement as a feedback loop. They try, you know? But the fact is they are linear by nature. And that's why, regardless of what we do, if there is not a reflective capacity, so we talk about it, we call it, you know, learn, do, and challenge. It is the challenge element that helps us to reflect rather than just accepting. Because a lot of what we do, there's a bit of learning, there's a bit of doing, and it just becomes innate in us. Makes sense? Because learning has to be intentional. So I think a lot of what we fail to do is we fail to challenge that, which is that deeper reflective process. We just tend to accept.
And that's why that's a lesson that took me a little while to learn, actually. When I talked about the PBED, the plan, brief, execute, debrief, I was talking a lot about the plan, brief, execute, and not talking as much as I should have been about the debrief. And it didn't take me too long, but we weren't doing the debrief as well as it should have been done. And that's actually what I told them, Brent. I said, can you guys come in and tell me a story of what just happened? Yeah. And whether it was a successful work event or whether there was some sort of a failure along the line, let's just tell the story. And that was gold, because it generated conversation and it generated a lot of learning. It was great.
And we try and suggest to people that when you're doing that debrief, to try and avoid the judgment element of success and failure, because that moves into judgment, because you're asking them to then, you know, make some decision making around that. Whereas what we talk to them about is trying just to get them to articulate where they had to make do. And making do, I think, sits very well within the vernacular of Australians and Kiwis, probably less meaning to North America. Because every day we're making frigging do. And I find people, it's far easier for them to share with you where they have to make do than ask them to say what went well, what didn't go well. So I could get the same group and ask those two things and get much deeper context from make do rather than saying what went well and what didn't go well. Because straight away you're asking people to move from that creative mind into the logic mind.
Yeah, okay.
Try it. It's an interesting little experiment.
I love it. It's really cool.
Everyone knows, you don't have to explain what make do means.
Like I said at the beginning, CSG had a very can-do attitude, right? They had to do their job. And because it's an Australian culture, it's a New Zealand culture as well, that's what we do. A lot of some of the guys and girls sort of said, hey, you come up with this PBED pair rule of three. We've got more than three things, so we have to stop work. It's like, okay, we don't have to stop work. This is just a pause. That doesn't mean we don't carry out the task. We still have to get things done. We still have to take care of business. This task needs to be completed. How do we do it safely? And it took a long time to get over that. And when this curiosity and these stories come out about those things, then they'd be like, okay, now I understand what I actually need to do to make this happen. So, yeah. And I think as well, from what you were saying with that debrief and the way you do it, this was literally just being one step ahead of the next person, because as I was listening to these podcasts and, oh, learning teams, what's that? Oh, psychological safety, what's that? It was a great, like you said, there's so much information out there, and being able to learn it in that manner was fantastic. We rolled a little bit of the learning teams concept into the debrief. Right, let's not solutionize yet. Let's just talk about what happened. Let's bring the stories out. And that just worked so well. It just blew my mind. It blew their minds. And the team that I was working with, it was so fun. It really was a good time.
Well, you can actually thank Einstein for that.
Thank you, Einstein.
Yeah, because he said if you spend 95% understanding the problem, you spend 5% solving.
There you go. Yes, it is so true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wonder in society now, in particular, that we jump too much to fix. Because the problem with fixing is that fixing doesn't create sustainable change. And recently I've been doing some work in some areas around psychological safety, which is always, fascinating, particularly around aggression. And the organisation kept having this fixed mind about how do we stop, aggression events. Or, we're having to constantly put our people back on training around de-escalation. And I just keep saying to them, in the absence of fixing, what are you left with? And I said, all you're left with is better understanding. So why don't, because I think people get disconnected between the notion of learning and improving. So humans, through the notion of learning, can improve and change their schema.
You absolutely can,
but
yes.
The system can't. So the system needs an improvement. So a lot of learning teams that we get involved in, we separate the difference between what people have learnt and what the organisation has learnt versus what the improvements are. And I know that's sometimes uncomfortable for people, because learning and improving are two different things. And what it's forced people to do is to basically say that the improvements are system focused, the learnings are people focused.
I like that. That's really cool. One thing, and I think this goes for any organization, one thing we really like to do is when you carry out a risk assessment for any activity, you get a group of people together who know what they're talking about, hopefully, and you come up with some of the things that can go right and some of the things that may go wrong. And you try to learn the best from them. A lot of the things we would get together as our team, have a little huddle from time to time and say, right, what have we learned in the past three or four courses that we can put back into policy? And when I say policy, I mean, the military runs on publications. So
absolutely. It's all system. Yeah.
Yeah. It's systems based. What can we implement back into this? So when people read a procedure, because of course we have our procedures as well, what can they learn from us that we're doing right now? And we did. We put a lot of work back into that to make sure that others can learn from what we were learning as well. And that's a fantastic opportunity as well.
Absolutely. And we must have systems. We need to do all those things. They're so important. We need those things. But Because, you know, people use the language of safety one, safety two, and it slightly aggravates me because it infers that it's a hierarchy or it infers it's a departure. And I just like to say to them that, you know, the difference here is that in safety one, we are expecting the people to conform to the system. In safety two, we're actually wanting the system to listen to the people.
Like I said, once we got over that management hurdle with a few of the naysayers, yes, that's what we got. We got them listening to the people, and it was great. And being able to go to like I had access to my commanding officer, like I could, you know, just knock on his door and say, "Good morning, sir. Have you got 5 minutes for a bit of a chat? Because this is what we've learned over the last period." And it was an amazing opportunity as well, because he had a lot of influence, and he would push up and push down.
Right. And what convinced him? Was it the stories that convinced him, or was it the numbers?
No, definitely stories. 100%.
Definitely stories.
Yeah, he didn't care about numbers. Yeah. He
didn't care about...
Nope. He was good. Yeah, he understood it. He got it straight away, which was amazing. Yeah.
It is, because you know, once again, it's that whole notion that we keep fixating on measurement.
I tell you what, that's always been a quandary of mine. If you're being aircrew, if you want to entertain a pilot, you put a graph up on a PowerPoint and they will sit there and stare at it all day long. They love it, right? But you can certainly show some sort of graph. You can almost make up whatever you wanted, right? You know, that's what they say. 85% of the statistics are made up on the spot.
It's just everyone learns differently. I mean, yeah. At the end of the day, it's no different. You know, in HOP learning teams, we use the blue line, black line. As a way of demonstrating things. But at the end of the day, it's just a graphical representation of it. And I think the challenge here is how do we bring, like the stuff that you're doing, it's how do you then make that common cultural practice so that it just becomes an embedded and sustainable part of what we do every day, with actually not having to think about it as a system, mm-hmm. because it's just a part of how we actually go about doing things.
It's just normal work. That's what we talked about at the beginning. It's all about keeping that plant watered, isn't it?
Absolutely. So it becomes an art form rather than a skill.
Yeah.
And that way, particularly where as work groups change, those people coming to that work group will then basically see what that cultural practice is, and they'll basically become part of it. Because ultimately we all conform, if that makes sense.
We do.
You either conform or you get out.
Especially if in the military.
I know we hate the bullying word, but a lot of conforming to cultural practice is a form of passive bullying. Because this is how we do things around here. And you either become part of how we do things around here, or you feel isolated.
Right, and then you're not innovating anymore, are you?
That's correct. So, you know, is that a form of passive bullying? It's an interesting conversation. Yeah. But I want to say to people is, people will either conform or they'll get out. So you can take someone from an amazing environment, and you would have seen that people leave the military going into civvy.
Yeah.
It's hard sometimes because they've come from this really well-structured environment with lots of support into something where there's just nothing and you've got to make it up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it can be quite tricky, yeah.
And that's that same thing. So you either join them or you go somewhere else. And that's the problem. But what you're doing is building a really strong cultural practice, which is amazing.
Yeah. And we had a lot of fun doing it at the same time. It was amazing. Yeah.
And were you looking for also those people that could then carry that through for others? So we talk about, you know, like coaching and mentoring, but I always talk about, you know, you got to find those people within the organization that can then go on to coach and mentor others.
Yeah. Long story short, absolutely. We found quite a few people to continue watering that tree, to continue that coaching and mentoring thing in the training. Like I said, I in the 2 years I was there, I was only able to train less than 1,000. It was only 800 people, in an organization with 15 or 1600 of support workers, you definitely need that throughput and that continuance. When it comes to passion, I shared all these podcasts with so many of my friends. Some of the innovators picked them up and went, "Yep, we'll have a look at them, 100%." And they ring me up and say, "Dave, we love these podcasts. They're awesome." And other guys are like, "No, I haven't listened to them yet." That's the hard part. You've got to be passionate if you want to share these messages and really make it work and be able to tell those stories so that they do make that strong organizational change. And that is a hard thing to find those people, isn't it? I'm sure you find the same.
It's always a challenge. And the good thing is you don't actually have to find many.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to, I suppose, nurture them and allow them to flourish. But for them to flourish in their own way, not try and become a clone of yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, that's that whole part of it. I do quite a bit. We call it cohort coaching, where we get groups of people together on their journey, and we get them to share, you know, their experiences, and we give them some things around reflection. But they say to us, you know, "What model are you using to do this?" And I said, "Yeah, it's called a frickin' learning team. We get together, you share your stories on where you're at. We explore what are some of the barriers to that. Okay, we focus on the problem and the situation. You guys self-diagnose, come up with a whole lot of different interesting suggestions, and our job is to facilitate that for the next session."
Yeah.
And they said, "Is that it?" They go, "Yeah, that is it." Because none of us are there to give you the answers. We're there to...
You've got to pay us way more for that.
I know. Well, but this is the crazy thing, because ultimately, and this sometimes frustrates me. I had someone the other day saying, you know, "We want you to train all these people." And I said, "I don't do training." "What do you mean you don't do training?" "Well, I got no idea." I said, "What we'll do is that we'll run a series of learning teams and understand with your people what are things that they're having to face to try and embed this into what they do in everyday work. And that through that journey, we'll be able to give them ways of building that knowledge component, so things like podcasts and other things,
mm-hmm.
because everyone's on their own journey. We call it like a roadmap. And we've got to scaffold people on that journey. And a lot of training doesn't allow us to scaffold. Because training, all training has a learning intention or learning outcomes. Seldom do we evaluate a person's prior knowledge and information as to where they sit. Yeah.
Yep, you just expect them to sit in a classroom and...
Yeah.
Listen or, yep.
And everyone will learn at a different pace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, so what we say to them is, you know, it's a journey. Okay. We need to be able to clearly articulate and describe what good looks like. Because otherwise, how can people aspire? But if you know where you're at and you know where you need to be, then going on that journey and being able to reflect back and see how you've progressed is what supports you to keep moving.
And there's a story in that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because so many people, you know, the best thing about a learning team is its organic nature. The worst thing about a learning team, it's its organic nature. So if you've come from a highly structured environment where you followed lots of process, then a learning team feels very foreign.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I find it comes down to the experience and the skill of the facilitator or the facilitators running that learning team to help cage that, to make sure that it doesn't go off crack and to make sure that you stay with the important things and get the required outcome that you need.
Absolutely, because we're trying to bridge people. I call it, you're going from cage tens to free range.
Oh, very nice. Yes.
And when you go free range, everyone goes running out and they keep looking around. They don't know where the hell they are. And they end up all running back in the cage because the cage seems really comfortable. I don't know if you've seen that analogy before.
I have, yes.
And I see that, and I particularly see that in this end of the world where people have been highly experienced in running ICAM investigations and then being asked to run a learning team, and it seems really scary to them. And what they'll do is they'll just default back to comfort because that's what's always worked for them in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, by doing that, they then blame the system. And I don't blame the person because the system wasn't there to support them, the fact that they're having to move from cage to free range.
Yes. Yeah.
And I can't tell you how long that takes for an individual because...
We're individuals.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to say we're all broken individuals on a good day. Yeah.
We've all got our things, Brent. Absolutely.
Yeah. So look, I would thank you for sharing your journey today, and I'd like to reconnect with you on some other stories as well, and because it's always fascinating the fact that the more stories we can share, and the fact that everyone goes on a different journey and for different needs. Is really powerful for the community and what they do.
Mate, thank you. And like I said as well, I stand on the shoulders of giants. You guys that are doing these podcasts and putting out these the white papers and the websites, you're helping so many communities out there, and we really appreciate it. So thank you very, very much for that.
Thank you, listeners, for being part of this podcast. We'd love to hear your learnings from today or other topics you would like us to support you on. Go to www.podcastlearnings.com and be part of the Community of Practice of Learning Teams at www.learningteamscommunity.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.
Welcome to Safety Differently Merchandise, the premium sponsor for the Practice of Learning Teams podcast show. Our curated lines of inspirational clothing, headwear, cups, stationery and more, at Safety Differently Merchandise, is befitting of your Safety Differently journey. I am Arthur Taylor, Chief Designer. I have spent decades on Savile Row, and honored to bring my talents, for all fine purveyors and devotees of HOP, Learning Teams, Safety Differently, Safety 2, and the New View. Please visit the store and purchase our fine goods at safetydifferentlymerch.com. And now, back to the show.